You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is episode 13, The Patagonian Revolution, part 3, The Avenger, The Avenger's Avenger, and The Avenger's Avenger's Avenger. Today I'm recording from the Calle Vetes Mental Hospital. To get started today, I would like to quote from the naval frigate captain Dalmiro Saenz and his report to the naval minister after the second wave of strikes. The ranchers dearly wanted the revolution put down before the shearing began. The numerous executions sowed terror and allowed them to force their peons back to work for lower pay. Here's what Colonel Varela's tombstone read. The British residents of Santa Cruz honor the memory of Lieutenant Colonel Varela, a paragon of honor and discipline in the performance of one's duty. Now, we saw how the massacres in Patagonia were carried out by the army for the ranchers and for British capital, all to keep wages low. Let's go through some of the events after these massacres. I would consider some of these events ranging from depressing to inspiring. So when Colonel Varela left Patagonia, he was sent off with a big ceremony, which was carried out by local government officials, the Rural Society, the Commerce and Industry League, and the Patriotic League. When he arrived in Buenos Aires, no one was there to greet Colonel Varela. Not even the federal government, nor the war ministry, nor even anyone from the army. Colonel Varela went to the war ministry and requested an audience with the war minister. Now, it's notable that he was neither sent for nor welcomed, right? Journalists were there waiting for him instead. The war minister, declined to meet with him, so Varela knew there was a chance he might be made into a scapegoat, or at least, you know, not warmly embraced. Varela started to set up a meeting with President Yrigoyen. Then, after leaving the war ministry, he spoke with the journalists outside, saying, "Before anything else, I must speak of the performance of the troops under my command, as well as of the civilians who accompanied us. They acted commendably at all times, and their behavior was worthy of the highest praise." Then Varela made a political misstep, though talking to journalists at all was probably a misstep. He took out a press clipping from an English-language newspaper to prove his point. The clipping was from the Magellan Times of Punta Arenas, which was a newspaper for Patagonia's British ranchers and merchants. It concluded by saying, "Patagonians should take off their hats to the 10th Argentine Cavalry and these very gallant gentlemen." Now, Argentines aren't dumb, right? Like, unless you're specifically beholden to British capital yourself, you know the role that it plays in the country, even if you're not opposed to it. And the British were praising Colonel Varela, which, you know, that's not a great sign, is it? President Yrigoyen kept pushing back his meeting with Colonel Varela. The newspapers continued to attack Varela. The anarchists, of course, attacked him the hardest, next the socialists, but even the liberal newspapers were swayed by the flow of accounts of just outright massacre coming out of Patagonia. Even the Radical Civic Union kept quiet, so the only people defending Varela after a certain point were the ultra-nationalists and the ultra-Catholics. Then, just a week or two later, the Socialist Party went nuclear. On February 1st, 1922, a simple congressman named Antonio de Tomaso took the floor, and he was pretending like he was going to speak on something innocuous, since the socialists had a reputation for rabble-rousing. De Tomaso got up, got the floor, and then he said, "Honorable deputies, a horrific tragedy has occurred in the territory of Santa Cruz." He continued staring at the Radical Civic Union leader in Congress. "All parties involved, particularly the nation's leading newspapers, have shrouded this affair in a heavy silence. But those of us who have accurate information about what has occurred, which now includes a large sector of the public, would become willing accomplices to this silence if we did not denounce these events within this chamber and if we did not demand the inquiry that our nation's honor requires. For many days now, our leading newspapers have accustomed us to reading headlines about banditry in Patagonia. They have led us to believe that the territory is home to an inexplicable horde of bandits operating outside all laws and with no purpose other than pillage. These bandits allegedly roam the countryside, spreading terror, destroying the social order, and preparing for a far-reaching revolution that would radiate north through the interior and along the coast. Many people have believed this legend, but the truth is beginning to come out. He went on saying, "Those responsible at the highest levels, foreseeing the possible consequences, have begun to speak, albeit indirectly, in order to cover up their own responsibility or to shift the blame to other government agencies. Honorable deputies, the so-called banditry in Patagonia is actually a labor movement, and I am not saying this capriciously or out of sectarianism. We can find the proof of this in official documents. I know that official documents are not often read in this country, but sometimes they can provide you with interesting information. In this case, in order to avoid accusations of bias regarding the events that have occurred in Patagonia since 1920, I want to cite the governor of Santa Cruz himself. At the request of the National Labor Department, he produced a report that included a great deal of information on the living conditions of the region's workers. At first, many believed that the military intervention would end as it did in 1920, that an unbiased outside force supported by the prestige of the federal government would work to their advantage. Instead, they carried out the massacre of which we have all heard. And to cover it up, they concocted a story of combat and to give the impression that there had been pitched battles, and that this was a perfectly armed and well-supplied military force that attacked the nation's troops. All of this is untrue. Of course, there is one key piece of information that all of the newspapers reported that would have been impossible to disprove. There were no casualties among the troops. It's incredible that a well-armed army of bandits, with fine sharpshooters fighting pitched battles, was unable to kill a single soldier while they died by the dozens. My words here, I'm skipping around, but De Tomaso's speech was exhaustive and yet still powerful. He continued, saying, "People have been killed indiscriminately, honorable deputies, for no reason, for no motive, and without the benefit of a trial. This should have never happened. The territory was not under martial law. Santa Cruz was not at war, and the military authorities did not have the jurisdiction to declare a state of emergency. If they had followed the instructions that they must surely have been given to restore order, there would have been arrested any men who were committing crimes, and then turned them over to the local authorities so that they could be taken to trial and then sentenced. I will not recount everything that occurred elsewhere in Santa Cruz. So as not to take up too much time, I merely wish to give this chamber an impression of the reasons behind the strike, the true character of the strikers, and the behavior of the troops, which is the responsibility of their officers, chiefly Lieutenant Colonel Varela, who briefly became the region's supreme dictator. Was Lieutenant Colonel Varela following orders when he committed these acts I deem to be so savage? It would be very interesting to know. It's hard for me to believe that there's an Argentine minister, much less a president, that would send in troops with the cruel and ungodly orders to have striking workers shot where they stood." Antonio de Tomaso bravely called out President Irigoyen for ordering the massacre. Now, this is the best you can expect from a parliamentary socialist party, and like I'm not being ironic, this is what they are supposed to do. So President Irigoyen finally met with Colonel Varela. Varela asked the president to issue a statement in support of his men and to promote his subordinates for their bravery. He did not ask for anything himself. President Irigoyen seems to have promised to do this, but after they met, no statements came out, no one was commended, and no one was promoted. There was not even a press release from the War Ministry relating to the whole affair. On February 8th, the Socialists in Congress called to create a committee to investigate the massacre in Patagonia. The radicals disagreed and they fought over it in Congress. This is where a lot of the myths about a Chilean insurgency got invented and trotted out. If you read the book, the Socialists absolutely tore into the radicals in very entertaining ways, and they helped delegitimize the radical party in the eyes of its constituency. There was quite a lot of interesting parliamentary debate, but I'm going to skip it. It's fun to read, though, if you end up reading the book. Still, the Radical Party had the votes to stop the investigation. They voted against it, so no investigation went forward. So what happened to Colonel Varela? Well, he played ball. He did not make things difficult for President Irigoyen. So what did that get him? Varela got named Commander of the Cavalry School. It's not what he wanted, but he was not forced to retire or hung out to dry. Things could have gone a lot worse for him. To quote Osvaldo Veyer here, President Irigoyen would deal with the labor problem caused by the repression in Patagonia the same way he dealt with the military. Compromise. Irigoyen's famous solution to all problems. I give in a little here, you give in a little there, and we'll meet in the middle. Judge Vinas carried out an investigation in Santa Cruz, which cataloged the fates of the survivors, and he mainly assisted the prisoners, most of whom, it should be obvious, were not guilty of any crimes. He also helped the survivors list out and itemize the items the soldiers stole from them. That is what a radical judge can do. He can't prevent a massacre, but he will definitely be there to help you make a formal claim against the army after the fact. On March 22, 1920, Colonel Varela was getting tired of being relentlessly attacked by the press. So he wrote a letter, and it explained quite a bit. And I quote from it now. The events that occurred in Santa Cruz, in which the regiment under my command was called to intervene, are being exploited for propagandistic purposes by the Party of Disorder, which is thoroughly anti-militaristic. This propaganda consists of inexplicable and degrading attacks on the military, sometimes personally directed against me, and sometimes directed against our military institutions as a whole. The newspapers La Vanguardia, La Montaña, and La Crítica have carried out a premeditated campaign to blacken the names of Argentina's military officers, and their goal is to make the public believe that this public institution is a servile instrument used by third parties to destroy their enemies. In light of these facts, I would like to explain the following. That the President has stated his approval of the actions taken by the troops under my command during the seditious movement in Patagonia. He has blocked any and all investigations into the actions of the troops, and in my presence promised that the War Minister would study my reports and issue a decree praising the Army's actions. Unquote. Now, the letter was much longer, but that's the relevant part, where he basically says, the President told me to do this. Now, if this is reminding you of the My Lai massacre and Lieutenant William Calley, why, I would agree with you. Anyway, President Irigoyen was nothing if not an extremely effective politician. So he emerged from this affair relatively unscathed. Things started to blow over. Well, that is until they blew up on January 25th, 1923. On January 25th, 1923, a man named Kurt Gustav Wilkins threw a bomb at Commander Varela. The bomb, however, shot shrapnel into both of their legs. Wilkins limped over to Commander Varela and unloaded his gun into him, killing him immediately. Wilkins' leg was broken, however, and he was unable to flee the scene. When the police arrived, they found a strange-looking foreigner who looked like a Scandinavian sailor. He handed the police his revolver butt first and said in broken Spanish, "I have avenged my brothers." Wilkins was a German anarchist of the Tolstoyan variety. He was an enemy of violence except in extreme cases, such as the massacre in Patagonia. The arresting officer instead punched him in the mouth and kicked him in the balls, and then they proceeded to beat him, as you might imagine. Now, the military blamed President Irigoyen more, if possible, than the anarchist who killed Commander Varela. The military had become very jaded against the civilian government. This whole affair contributed greatly to the increasing and eventual disdain that the Argentine military had towards democracy. If you know your Argentine history, you know that this leads to multiple coups and dictatorships. And while I do not view Commander Varela as a hero, there was obviously a certain personal bravery to his actions. He had a certain passionate intensity, while the worst, President Irigoyen, lacked all conviction, if we're flipping Yates on his head. Now that Varela was dead, could there be any justice for Patagonia? Of course not. President Irigoyen was still in office. Neither did Varela get any posthumous promotions or commendations either. So who was Vilkins, apart from being a Tolstoyan anarchist, right? Vilkins was a Silesian miner who emigrated from Germany to the United States. He had actually been a traveling gentleman hobo for a time, traveling around with a bindle, just like in old cartoons or something, right? He worked all over the country. He was actually in Bisbee, Arizona, during the strike and deportation in 1917. This was a very famous incident in U.S. labor history. Look it up, the Bisbee strike. It's insane. Vilkins later spent time in Washington State, hanging out with the Krauts and Swedes there. He worked in Colorado, and he was eventually deported back to Germany in 1920 because he had been photographed, and a newspaper in the United States called him the most dangerous Red in the West. Vilkins eventually found his way to Argentina, where he caught a case by accident talking to an undercover cop. He was arguably framed for carrying subversive literature, although the subversive literature in question was simply a newspaper clipping about himself being the most dangerous Red in the West. I would point out the irony of the most dangerous Red in the West being so easily caught and provoked by the police. But then, of course, I remembered he literally did kill Commander Varela, so. In Argentine prison, Vilkins met some of the more hardcore Argentine anarchists. After prison, Vilkins was injured in a workplace accident. This reduced his possible earning potential, and it's possible that the injury influenced his decision to strike out for proletarian justice. His friends remembered that Vilkins was deeply affected by the news of the Patagonian executions. Months before his attack on Varela, he started to distance himself from his friends and from his anarchist acquaintances in order to keep them from catching a case as accomplices. From what we know about Vilkins, we know that he believed that all military men, without exception, were conscious of the uselessness of their profession, but had only realized it when it was too late. This is why they felt such hatred towards the common man. They developed a complex, having felt betrayed by the parents or teachers who had encouraged them to sign up. Those who knew Vilkins said that whenever he saw men in uniform, he stopped to stare at them with a look of pity and sorrow in his face. Deep down, he considered them to be humanity's most unfortunate victims, but victims who had become the executioners of humanity, of their own brothers. To an extent, this reminds me of the conversation I had on the Trillbillies episode with Terrence and Dimitri, talking about the Bleeding Edge novel and the main character Maxine having such pity and compassion for Nicholas Windust, the right-wing former death squad fed, basically. So, like I said, the police tortured Vilkins after his arrest. They mainly wanted to know about possible accomplices. All he could say in his limited and broken Spanish was, "I was alone, intellectual author. I made the bomb without help, individual act." At Commander Varela's funeral, it was basically just his close family and a large contingent of prominent British businessmen and the British ambassador. They insisted on singing, "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow."
For he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, which nobody can deny, which nobody can deny, which nobody can deny. For he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, which nobody can deny, for he's a jolly good fellow, which nobody can deny.
I swear, the British are so degenerate. In mid-April, Vilkins was mostly healed up, and so he was transferred from a hospital to a prison. By June, his trial had been progressing, and so the prosecutor asked for a 17-year prison sentence, which was towards the high end of what was, you know, legally allowed. The defense team and his prison support group had been hearing rumors that the Argentine Patriotic League was planning to murder Vilkins. They were not sure if this was a serious threat, but they spoke with the warden about it. They even switched his prisons to ward off a potential attack. Nevertheless, a man named Jorge Ernesto Perez Millon Temperley entered the prison dressed as a jailer. He was from an aristocratic family. He was a member of the Argentine Patriotic League, and he was loosely related to Commander Varela. His sister married the brother of Varela's wife's brother. Perez Millon found Vilkins asleep in his cell. He woke him up and asked, "Are you Vilkins?" "Jawohl," responded Vilkins in German. Then Perez Millon pulled out a Mauser and shot Vilkins in the chest near the heart, mortally wounding him. As if Vilkins' heart was too strong, he held on for 2 days before dying. To quote Osvaldo Baer, "Perez Millon was very nervous. He made for the cell door as if to close himself inside and thus conceal his crime." Inspector Luis Conti would later say that, when asked what happened, Perez Millon's first words would be, "I served under Commander Varela, who is my kin. I have avenged his death." He sounded like he was going to burst into tears and added that he woke the prisoner and asked his name before firing. The president of Argentina was reportedly infuriated because Vilkins was basically shot in his jail cell while asleep, and of course it looked like the government ordered it, or at least allowed it. Now, as you might expect, this caused the anarchists to declare war. One anarchist newspaper read, "Vilkins was murdered in the federal prison, a cowardly and despicable act of vengeance. We must declare a strike, starting immediately to protest this treacherous crime. Anarchists, workers, dignified men, show your repudiation of this infamous act of cowardice. We must vindicate the sacred name of our avenger. We must initiate a general strike, starting immediately. The proletarian must not remain indifferent to this nameless infamy. Kurt Vilkins was treacherously murdered in the federal prison. His death cannot go unpunished." First, the bakers voted to go on strike, then the chauffeurs, the painters, the sawyers, the brickmakers, the fuel delivery men, the construction workers, and the metal workers. Eventually, they all voted on having, you guessed it, a general strike. Another publication read, "Workers, let nobody remain silent. To not protest in the midst of this emergency would mean solidarity with the barbarous events in Patagonia and the repulsive murder committed in the federal prison. Comrades, proletarians, men of conscience, to the streets." The syndicalists, socialists, and communists all joined in on the general strike. The non-anarchist newspapers had completely contradictory versions of the murder. The president of the Argentine Patriotic League, Manuel Carles, offered police chief Fernandez the use of 43 civilian brigades to help restore order. There was quite a lot of, you know, civil disturbance. There were shootouts with many workers and several police shot, and the riots would go on for weeks. But, so, who was this Jorge Ernesto Perez Millon Temperley? He was just 24 years old when he killed Vilkins. He had a troubled childhood. He ran away from home several times, dropped out of school, collected firearms. He was an obsessive Catholic. He developed an early interest in ultranationalism and anti-liberalism. He joined the Radical Civic Union and the Argentine Patriotic League, and he often handled security at their events. I'm telling you, this guy sounds like Thane Eugene Caesar, I tell you what. It has been alleged that Perez Millon was a homosexual. And I mean, he was a proto-fascist, so maybe. But either way, it's not like it has too much of a bearing on, you know, his actions. Perez Millon fought briefly in a civilian paramilitary in Patagonia during the first wave of strikes, but he surrendered to El Toscano's fighting unit. Then he joined the Coast Guard as a cadet, but he was kicked out for misconduct. At Varela's funeral, he refused to leave the coffin and began shouting that he would avenge his death. Reportedly, Perez Millon actually did get a job as a jailer at that prison, though we can question whether someone on the inside was assisting him, right? Because After Vilkins was transferred to a different prison, Perez Millon was transferred there too, if you catch my drift, right? So when Perez Millon was arrested, they did not handcuff him, and his story was that he had a hallucination, and he began to feign madness. He was held in a different prison because the authorities feared a revenge killing, as well they should. Eventually, in April 1925, Perez Millon was sentenced to the minimum sentence for murder, 8 years in prison. The reason the judge gave for leniency was his adventures, his idealism, his artistic inclinations, his neurasthenia, his participation in the struggle against the revolutionary strikers in the South, and the vandalism he witnessed there, his passionate love affair with his first girlfriend, his attraction to the nomadic life, and the lack of a harmonious relationship with his family, unquote. Which, I mean, like, sure, man, like, whomst among us does not have weak nerves, which leads us to murder? Shortly afterwards, Perez Millon was transferred from prison to a mental hospital. The medical report said Perez Millon suffered from a delirium of systematic persecution, characteristic of degenerates. Which, I mean, the degenerate part sounds like, you know, an indication that he might have been gay in the parlance of the time. But what sticks out to me was the delirium of persecution, which, like, no, I do not think he was delirious about people being after him, right? They were after him. Perez Millon spent several months at the mental hospital, and he shared a cell with another scion from high society. I will quote from Osvaldo Bayer here. On November 8th, Perez Millon is moved into a new hospital wing with 11 new, poorer inmates. Among them is a 26-year-old Yugoslav named Esteban Lucic. He is short and slightly hunched over. Everyone treats him like he's harmless, even though he's there for having shot a man. The Yugoslav was sentenced to 17 and a half years in prison. After a few months' imprisonment, however, Lucic was transferred to the mental hospital on Calle Vetes because of his evident madness. Despite his appearance, Lucic is one of the mental hospital's most beloved patients. He earns a little money by working as a servant for the more well-off nurses. He shines their shoes, he makes beds for them, he sweeps the floor. He never gets upset, and no one sees him as anything but the good lunatic. This lasts until the morning of November 9th, 1925. That day, Perez Millon seems edgy and ill at ease. He had been writing at his desk since very early in the morning, not even bothering to eat breakfast. He carries on until lunchtime when he puts down his pen and eats silently before continuing with his letter. At 12:30, Lucic, the good lunatic, asks with his characteristic humility to enter the wing housing the well-to-do patients. He normally doesn't even bother to ask and simply goes in. No one has any objections. Lucic crosses the hall and looks through the doorway to see Perez Millon writing at his desk. Lucic steps forward, draws a pistol from his pocket, aims at Perez Millon, and tells him, "This is from Vilkins." Startled, Perez Millon turns around and takes a bullet in the chest. He throws himself to the floor like a cat, saving himself from the second gunshot. The bullet lodges itself in the wall. He grabs the hunchback by the arm and pushes him to the ground. Lucic fires again, the bullet grazing Perez Millon's pelvis and lodging itself in his left thigh. But the victim has managed to take control of the situation. He disarms the Yugoslav and starts beating him. A nurse arrives, alerted by the hysterical cries of the patients, and saves Lucic from Perez Millon. Lucic is put in a straitjacket while Perez Millon is taken to the emergency room. The wound in his chest is quite serious, but the doctors are confident that they can save him. After the operation, Perez Millon is given 30 days of bed rest. But how was a new episode in this never-ending story possible? How could Perez Millon have been attacked when such pains had been taken to place him beyond the reach of the long arm of vengeance. Was he not being held in the safest of places? And had Lucic decided to kill Perez Mion on his own? No, there was a plot that only could have been hatched by those incredible anarchists who never give up, no matter how many times they've had a lesson beaten into them. Is Lucic an anarchist? No, he was a member of Fora when he was working, but that is not enough to define him ideologically. It's clear that Lucic was armed by someone else, that he was used as a tool. Straight-jacketed, Lucic is interrogated, but no matter how many times he's beaten, he continues to parrot the line that he seems to have been told to memorize. He said, "I found the revolver on Perez Mion's desk. When he started hitting me, I shot him in self-defense." The interrogation has to be brought to a halt because the lunatic is in such a state of excitement that it's impossible for him to have an orderly conversation. But the investigation is in the hands of none other than Inspector Santiago, the chief investigator for the Buenos Aires police. He is lucid, quick on his feet, and has the nose of a bloodhound. Possessing the mentality of the capital city, he knows when it's time to shoot and when it's time to go soft. A radical with his own brand of politics, he's not above playing the numbers game organized by the local party boss. He has a deep understanding of human nature and won't let those responsible for the events at the mental hospital get away so easily. He realizes after interrogating him for only 2 minutes that Lucic did not act alone. Behind him, there's someone bold and intelligent who managed to overcome every barrier to the vengeance promised by the anarchists. Santiago asked for a complete list of the mental hospital's patients and employees. He scanned the list and suddenly jumped out from his seat as if everything had been cleared up, shouting, "Boris Vladimirovich." Boris Vladimirovich, it couldn't have happened any other way. As if we were living through the tale of the Russian Revolution, full of Bulgarian conspirators or Serbia's Black Hand. The mental hospital has been treating none other than Boris Vladimirovich, who was transferred from Ushai just 2 months earlier. But how did Boris Vladimirovich end up at the asylum? And who is he? Boris Vladimirovich is a true anarchist, an import, a white Russian, with decades of agitation and conspiracy under his belt. He resembles a character from Hemingway, Melville, Jack London, Joseph Conrad. He had a large black mustache, wavy hair, and penetrating eyes, unquote. And who was Boris Vladimirovich? He was a highly educated Russian aristocrat. He married a revolutionary worker when he was 20 years old, and he renounced his family and fortune. He went to school, he became a doctor and a biologist. He authored 3 books of sociology. He was fluent in German, French, Russian, and Spanish. He was also a painter, in the avant-garde, like, milieu, right? At first, he was a social democrat, and he even participated in the Socialist Congress in Geneva in 1904, where he disagreed with Lenin. In later years, he was responsible for a series of bombings in Moscow, St. Petersburg, Paris, and Barcelona. Vladimirovich's wife died, and then the Russian Revolution of 1905 failed. Both of these events plunged him into alcoholism. As a response, he emigrated to Argentina, where he eventually got involved with the illegal anarchist expropriators. Maybe one day I'll do an episode on them as well, but we'll see. I need a break from Argentina after this. So after La Semana Trágica, Tragic Week, the Argentine one that is, Vladimirovich saw the Patriotic League persecuting immigrants and Jews, just like the Black Hundreds did in Russia. As a result, he felt it was his duty to warn his countrymen living in Argentina. He also felt the need to tell the world about the October Revolution, because he believed it would set men free. So Vladimirovich became obsessed with having his own printing press. But that costs money. As Vladimirovich would explain in the weeks following his arrest, a newspaper is key because those who come to Argentina from Russia are the dregs of the people, many of them Jews, and they form an incoherent mass incapable of committing to a serious revolutionary plan. much less implementing a grand theory. The answer, of course, would be to have a newspaper. To fund the newspaper, Vladimirovich organized a high-profile robbery, but he and his ring were caught. He was sentenced to life in prison. At first, he was sentenced to death. It was, you know, commuted. Osvaldo Veyer says, "Here we can see the blindness of justice. Vladimirovich, who had committed a robbery but killed no one, was condemned to life in prison, but Perez Mion Temperley, who had murdered a sleeping man in cold blood, abusing his privileges as a prison guard, received only 8 years. When informed of his sentence, the professor Boris Vladimirovich blithely stated, "The life of a propagandist such as myself is prone to such contingencies. It's as true today as it will be tomorrow. I know that I will not live to see the triumph of my ideas, but sooner or later others will come along to take my place." Vladimirovich was sent to Ushai, even though he was just a first-time offender, right? As with Simon Radowitzky, he found it ironic that he was sent to a prison that so resembled the Tsarist gulag. At Ushai, due to the harsh conditions and beatings, he became paralyzed. He was already kind of old, but how did he end up at the mental hospital? Shortly after arriving at Ushai, Vladimirovich started to show clear signs of derangement. He didn't eat, he sang old Russian songs, he gesticulated wildly, he couldn't walk, and he spent the day praying on his knees, which could only be a sign of incurable madness for an anarchist. The warden already had enough problems with Simon Radowitzky, so he requested Vladimirovich be transferred to asylum. And Argentina only had one asylum for the criminally insane, the one that Perez Mion was at. Vladimirovich worked with the Yugoslav to strike out at Perez Mion. The aforementioned Inspector Santiago ordered Boris Vladimirovich to be brought to him. He was brought out on a stretcher to see Inspector Santiago. He was placed face to face with the police officer. He looks like a ghost. He's barely 49 years old, but it looks like he's in his 70s. The only thing he has left is his penetrating gaze. Years of imprisonment have broken him physically, but his eyes still have their old fire. Although the police officer was convinced that Vladimirovich was the intellectual author of the attacks on Perez Mion, it was difficult to prove, especially because the attacker, Lucic, only ever repeated that he found the gun on the victim's desk. And so Vladimirovich continued to smile. They could not prove anything. And so his revenge for Vilkin's death is complete." Unquote. Perez Mion's coffin was draped in the Argentine flag. The Patriotic League attended his funeral, shouting, "Long live the army and the fatherland," and "Death to anarchism, maximalism, and agitators." The police never could prove that Boris Vladimirovich killed Perez Mion, but Vladimirovich could not withstand the police's beatings. In the last months of his life, he was left paralyzed from the waist down, in a cell, forced to drag himself around on the floor of his cell, soiled with his own excrement. The cycle of revenge was finished. For sources today, I used the book Rebellion in Patagonia, and to a lesser extent, the other books we mentioned, mostly Rebellion in Patagonia. It's amazing. Can't recommend it enough. Thanks for listening, dear listener. You are already on the free side, so just tell a friend about the show. See you next episode, and God bless.
Снова взрыв и кранты бойцу. Руби штандарт, пали знамена. Я разрешаю, я атаман. Мне наплевать, кто там сплоченный. Всех разметает наш ураган. Вот на казачий разъезд напоролись. Ой, мама, держи меня. Я не знаю, за что боролись. Попался, пеняй на себя. Мама, анархия. Mama. брата прощения, я всех расстрелял, это ихний пробел. А председатель сельсовета скрыться хотел в черной ночи, хоть черный, хоть красный, хоть синего цвета, всех цветных просто напрочь в мочи. Вот вдалеке черносотенцы скажет: ой, мама, держи меня. Я это знаю, но какая задача, попался, пеняй на себя.